I mean, we're going through a complete mental health crisis, but stress is the biggest killer globally. I think as humans, we don't understand how strong we are until we're really challenged. Don't think about all the bells and whistles, just nail the basics. Nail the art of turning up every day.
Welcome to The Conversation. In today's episode of Trailblazers, Johnny is speaking to Bianca Arrigo, co-founder of Human OS.
Well, absolutely wonderful to have you here, Bianca.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. How's the start of your 2024 been?
Interesting. Yeah, flawed with some sort of illness. Like, I feel so many of us have been recently. Annoying, because I don't usually get ill. So when I do...
Well, it's not ideal after you come back from a break as well.
I know. So annoying. I came back feeling so good. And I was like that really annoying smug person back from holiday. Like, oh, I feel great. Gonna take over the world.
All tanned and ready to go. Yeah. And then all bunged up.
Yeah, it's awful. But getting there now.
Well, thank you for being here. Really appreciate you. Would love to find out a little bit more from your side of things about Human OS and the amazing work that you're doing with that. A little bit of your journey into that as well.
Amazing. Yeah, so Human OS, we are a health optimization platform, effectively. What we are really trying to do is revolutionize the way corporate companies approach their well-being. I think, you know, as you know, there's a plethora of well-being services and solutions out there. You know, the term corporate well-being is thrown around all the time. And for me, it's something that I just believe we're getting really wrong. And the fact is that stress, depression, anxiety, all these issues, they're at all-time highs. And so although there's more services than there's ever been, there's more budget, there's more people, you know, investing and looking at these things, there's still a fundamental flaw. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing the problems we have. So that's why we sort of came up with Human OS and the idea behind it. And a lot of what we're trying to do is actually bridge that gap between the need of the individual and the health of the individual, the need of the company, and, you know, the performance of the company, and actually how can we focus on both things at once. So you're optimizing the individual, you're optimizing the business, and actually, you know, you're improving the life of everyone.
Yeah, so you've got your individualistic tailored plan if you're an employee, and then you've got kind of the data being anonymized, probably fed back to the company, that lets you know in a general sense where your team are, what levers you might want to pull in terms of like increasing satisfaction, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we're a data-driven company. And so what we look to do, we use our coaches. So we've got in-house therapists, nutritionists, personal trainers, osteopaths, personal development coaches, executive coaches. We've just expanded the team, which is why I'm having to think here. I do know what my business does. But we've got our in-house coaches, and we do, you know, one-to-one coaching. We do masterclasses. That's like our workshops, effectively. But we do also a lot of tracking of behaviours and the habits and the data. So that what that then allows us to do is build reports that we can feed back to organisations. So we can say, look, this is exactly what's going on within your business. These are your burnout risks. These are your stress rates. These are your sleep incidences. And so we can build a really good picture of exactly what the challenges are that their employees are facing. Like you said, all anonymized. And then we can help build them effective well-being reports, well-being strategies to implement that will improve the culture, the environment, the systems of the well-being within the workplace, but then also improve the performance of the business.
Yeah, so within that, I'm guessing, obviously, I'm not going to ask you exactly how it all does that. It's going to be very under the hood. But are you supplying devices? Are you tracking things like wearables and all of that sort of stuff from like your Auras, your Whoops?
Yeah, and also don't ask me because I'm not the technical side of the business. Fair. So if you do ask me, my answer will be very quick and be like, speak to my co-founder. But no, we integrate with all the wearable pieces. So what we're able to do using our questionnaires on our platform. And another thing is what we're trying to reduce is the number of questionnaires and surveys and things like that people have to fill out because people are just bored and tired of them. So when you onboard onto the platform, we ask you one set of questions and this gives us all the data we need. Therefore, whenever you need coaching, you can just get coaching straight away. There's no more waiting times, no more reports. But without those questions and then the integration with the wearable pieces, it allows us to get a really good idea of exactly what's going on. It actually allows us to give every one of our users a biological age, and then we can track their age and how they reverse their age effectively with the human OS mythology.
That's super cool. What was the reason for getting into this whole space, considering obviously the challenges that you mentioned, where there's a lot of people approaching this probably negatively or badly from your experience? Like, what was the point at which you thought, do you know what, we can do something better, and this is where we really would add that value?
Yeah, I think for me, there's been certain points in my life which have been almost curveballs or challenges that have sort of set me in a slightly different direction. And I've always been fascinated with human health, human behaviour, studied psychology at university, loved it. And actually originally thought I'd go down that route of the clinical psychology and sort of pursue a career in that area. And when I graduated, I found out, I think it was about two weeks after I graduated, I found out my dad had 3 months left to live. And so this was like the first time in my life that I realised life doesn't happen how we think it's going to happen. A very long story short, I had to get a job and get a job quickly. And my only motivation is money. All I wanted to do was buy my dad his health or a Ferrari. And, you know, nothing else mattered. That was just the goal. So my life sort of flipped upside down. And then all of a sudden I found myself in this corporate world on a sales floor of about 800 people, one of very few women, youngest person in the company, in this really sort of high-pressured, aggressive sales environment. Very Wolf of Wall Street-esque. and this is my first job, as in my early 20s. It was just, it was crazy. Within my first year, I was sort of in the top performing sales team globally, had these huge targets, lots of pressure. And still at this time, my dad was getting progressively more ill. He lived longer than those 3 months, but you know, he didn't have that long. And so when he passed away, I had been working 20-hour days. I was doing 7 days a week at times. You know, my dinners every night were Weetabix and a bottle of red wine. I wasn't looking after my health. Physically, emotionally, it wasn't a priority. And when my dad passed, I became very ill. I ended up in hospital. The doctor said that because I was so strong-minded, I'd keep on going and going and going. And so my body physically started shutting down. I couldn't digest my food. I couldn't sleep lying down. I was in pain from head to toe. And I was, now looking back, what I was in was this really extreme burnout, effectively, where my cortisol levels were so high, my body physically stopped being able to work effectively. And so at that point, there was a first moment, I guess, which then changed my trajectory and led me to where I am now, which was just how important our health is, firstly, and actually how it's a privilege. And when you lose someone to a disease, to an illness, it sort of changes your perception of health, and you don't take it for granted anymore. But it also, for me, when I was in hospital just after I'd lost my dad, it started, I guess, this like light bulb moment in me where I was like, why are we not talking about this? Like, if stress alone has done this to me, we need to be discussing this. Like, this is a real physical thing. Like, this is something, and this was pre-pandemic, so it didn't have the spotlight on it as much as we did now. And so I guess that sort of then I quit my job, I went traveling, I did a lot of investing, first off, in my own healing and my own stress management, my own personal development. Then I went into one-to-one coaching because I wanted to help others on that one-to-one basis. And then I saw this opportunity in the corporate world, especially when the pandemic happened. And, you know, corporate companies, they couldn't just take their employees to get drunk or to fancy restaurants or nice holidays. Like, they had to actually be looking after them. And so I started the corporate branch of the business and doing talks and delivering wellbeing strategies, because I think, you know, you can... And this is so much about what Human OS is about. You can give the individual the tools and the environment and what they need to be able to be the best versions of themselves. But if they're always going into an environment that's toxic and that's damaging,
yeah,
it reverses it. So you need to be working with the organisations as well. And so that's where that started. And then I met my now business partner. And he's, like you say, he's the product and tech side. And he's like, I think I've got a platform that we can build for this. And as you know, everything now is data, 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 data. And bottom line, what's the impact on my bottom line?
100%.
So we were like, well, we need to show now the data and the actual physical impact this can have on the business performance. And so I guess in a very long answer to that question, it was a collection of all these events that led to what HumanOS is now.
Yeah. Well, it's just a stacking, right? And first and foremost, thank you for sharing that. Obviously, painful background to where it initially started from, but now where it is. I think you're so spot on in the fact that it takes a village.
Yeah.
And you can't really do things on your own. And if you're going into those environments where, I think one of the things that I guess is a question that I have to you is that are a lot of corporates probably still masking the toxicity of a culture that demands so much from their employees in terms of like the work that they're demanded or asked to do? Asked.
Yeah.
It's not that it's, you know, pressured or expected of you too much. Are they using those other events, like, you know, the going out, the getting drunk and kind of like those dinners as a way to just kind of like, oh, that's enough. We give you the opportunity to let off some steam rather than truly investing in actually looking after their team in the way that those companies that you're working with seems like they're actually taking that on as a genuine point of care.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the problem that more and more businesses are going to have is as younger generations come through, they don't care. They don't want to go out and get drunk. They don't want the fancy holidays, you know. They're like, well, I want to work from home on Fridays. I want to start at 10 a.m. Like, I want 1 month working abroad. Like, they want true flexible working arrangements. And so companies are going to have to listen to that. If they still want to attract and retain top talent, they have to understand the demands of that top talent are changing rapidly. And I also just think a huge problem is lots of people do want to work hard, you know, especially our type A personalities. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. We're both like that. We love big goals. We love big challenges. We love working hard. We love that sort of, we thrive off it. We wouldn't be fulfilled if we weren't like that. And so there's nothing wrong with that, but companies have to be honest about what you're going to get. You know, you can say, we expect you to work hard.
Yeah.
We expect you to work additional hours sometimes. We expect you to have to like prioritize and sacrifice things at points, but in return, you will be looked after. And I think that's where the discrepancy is, and they're not doing the correct things to look after their employees.
Yeah, I think there is a duty of care now more than ever. And I think as you hit on that earlier, you know, with COVID, that was kind of the tipping point, right? It seemed a lot of people had gone from working in the offices traditionally, working from home. And I think that the insidious demands that were put on them previously with the working hours and stuff, because they were literally at their laptop and had nowhere else to go, No one was saying to anyone that's at any point, well, hang on a minute, you've been online since 6 and I can see that you're online at like 11, 12 o'clock at night. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Get off the computer for crying out loud. And it seems like that duty of care is now actually being taken more seriously with the companies that you're working with and the people that are trying to get the best out of their staff and find that balance. Are there still kind of barriers that you're seeing in terms of a cultural thing in terms of like what people are almost like we feel like we should do within the office, that sometimes it kind of points as a way for them to be saved from themselves as well with what you're doing?
Yeah, totally. And I think also, you know, a lot of the time we do see companies are trying. And it's not their fault they're getting it wrong. They've bought the wellness solution. It's not being used. They're doing the lunch and learns. They're not being attended. They're doing the free yoga or the fruit in the office, you know. But these things, like, how much actual benefit do they have?
Yeah.
And it has to go deeper than that. And so I think a lot of organizations, like, they have invested, it's not worked. So now they're like, well, why would we even bother investing? Or they're just completely lost with what is an actual effective solution for our employees. And differentiating, like alluding to what you've just said, like differentiating what is the responsibility of the workplace? What is the responsibility of the individual? Where do these two things meet, and what do you have to do to make a successful relationship between those two things? And that's where we have a lot of conversations and do a lot of work around is what actually is an effective strategy here, and how do we take responsibility? Who takes ownership of what? And how do we encourage both parties to take ownership to allow for the success of both?
How do you fold in the kind of like the mental health aspect of all of this sort of stuff as well? Obviously, again, coming back to one of the things that I think we saw a massive kind of attention and focus on, which wasn't previously recognised, was the impact of mental health in the workplace and how it plays such a crucial, obviously it plays such an amazing role in how we show up, how we're able to tackle with issues and stuff like that. How are you folding those types of things into the platform? And
yeah, I mean, we're going through a complete mental health crisis, and there's no two ways about that conversation. You know, stress is the highest ever been. It's, I think 85% of Brits stress regularly. One in six people in the UK now suffer a mental health disorder. Resilience is the lowest it's ever been, and it's significantly lower under 30s. Females under 30 at 20% more risk of depression than any other age group or gender group now. And so there's, you know, I could reel off facts all day, but it's just depressing.
Yeah.
There's an irony in that. but, you know, so yes, we are absolutely in a crisis, and there's a whole combination of factors why, you know, it's a particularly unstable time in the world. We've come out of pandemic. No one's ever learned how to live through a pandemic in our lifetime. Political unrest, financial uncertainty, pressures, modern day stressors, you know, sleep issues, anxiety issues, all these things are feeding into it. So it's a conversation that's definitely needed to be had, and we have to start putting actions in place to overcome this challenge and overcome, you know, these problems that we're having. Because like we said, like, stress is the biggest killer globally. It's something like 70% of basis of all illness and disease. Wow. You can link back to stress. So it's a conversation we have to be having, and actually how do we overcome this?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I didn't realize that it was that prevalent. I had an inkling that it was high. I didn't realize it was that that catastrophic, let's be honest. And you touched on something there, resilience.
Yeah.
Really fascinating and wonderful topic that I think we could probably do a whole other podcast on. You're obviously someone that has a great degree of resilience and
sometimes
resist the cookie. but with resilience being obviously so low, like, what are some of the ways in which we can probably cultivate that more? What are the tools that we can empower people with to build that?
Yeah, well, this is the thing about resilience. Resilience is a learned behavior. It's not something you just have. Okay, yes, genetically we may have higher or lower levels of predispositions towards resilient traits, but it's a learned behavior. So the biggest mistake people think when it comes to doing well in life and being able to adapt and evolve is they think, well, if I avoid stress, then I'll be okay. And that's the complete incorrect mindset to have. Actually, we need to be under stress. We need to learn how to manage stress effectively, like at a cellular level. So the body has to learn how to respond to the stress. The cells have to learn how to respond. So when it comes to resilience, we need to be placing ourselves under controlled stress. And starting off small, especially if you are someone who gets really overwhelmed, you know, naturally you stress a lot, naturally you're more anxious. It's not a case of, okay, go jump out of a plane, you know, or doing something massive, or quit your job and move to the other side of the world. It doesn't have to be that, but it has to be, how are you going outside your comfort zone and doing so regularly so you learn that you can overcome these challenges and you learn that, you know, you can overcome stress and actually you're not avoiding it, but you're operating really effectively within it.
That's really, really interesting insight. So it's about not avoidance of stress entirely. It's actually just controlling the level of exposure that you have and doing that in almost a scientific way to push you towards that edge of your comfort and then kind of like, cool, I can sit with that for a little bit. And then you just build on that over time.
It's like exactly the same as exercise. And when you go to the gym and then you go to the gym and then you tear the muscles and then they grow back stronger because the muscles then know how to respond to the stress, to the tear. And so then you get bigger muscles. It's the same with resilience. You have to go stress, then learn how to respond to that stress, and then you come back a bit stronger each time to a level.
Yeah.
Not too much, because then it goes the other way. But it's a double-edged sword. And so we need stress. You know, eustress. Eustress is a positive type of stress. It motivates us to get out of bed, to want to do well at work, to go exercise, to have good relationships. But it's that double-edged sword. And actually, it then if there's too much, it becomes really debilitating.
Yeah. I think that's I think is really key there is, as you say, it's the right amount of stress, but it's not kind of like the complete avoidance of that. It's the acceptance of that never being something that you really want to completely remove, because within your life, you need friction. As you say, it's the thing that gets you out of bed. It's the motivation to do better and the things that drive you. Within that, there seems to be kind of, I guess, a level of self-awareness that you maybe need as well in order to know when too much stress is too much.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's kind of another question and another mechanic that you can kind of like ask. How do you go about developing that self-awareness to be able to know where the parameters of your resilience or your stresses are so that you can create that?
I mean, I'm still trying to work that one out.
You and me both, pal. If you figure that one out before me, please go ahead and tell me. I would appreciate the note.
I mean, whoever figures that one out and writes a book on that.
Yeah, that is definitely one of life's biggest conundrums.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, that's the thing. And I've been reading about this a lot recently, especially in terms of like, why is resilience so low? And, you know, it's because effectively, and this is a good thing, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but in the modern world, it's more easy than ever to survive. So therefore, we're not learning natural behaviours or, you know, natural mechanisms that once would have allowed for our survival.
Yeah.
And so when you listen to people speak on it, podcasts and, you know, successful, and I use this term really loosely because I think success means something
different things to
everyone.
Different people.
Exactly. When you listen to top business people speak, or, you know, top musicians or actors or whatever, people who are at the top of their field, it's very, well, I'm yet to ever hear someone say, you know, I just woke up one day and I got here and it was all really easy and it was really fun. You know, they tend to have like these really horrific stories or something really challenging has happened. And I think as humans, we don't understand how strong we are until we're really challenged. And then when you do start to realize that strength, things then, you take them in your stride. It's a lot easier to adopt that growth mindset to situations. And so I think that's the people who do the best is like the people who can apply that growth mindset and overcome those stresses and use that stress to their advantage.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's, you know, Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, and so many amazing lessons in that, in that regard. And it's even to do with, I think, one of the things I'm really looking at the moment is the whole neuro-linguistic programming side of things and how actually the way in which you praise your children can have an impact in terms of, you know, that resilience piece where actually saying, oh, you did amazing, you're so wonderful, and this and that and the other. And then they're confronted with the reality that they may not be the best at that. That's a much harder pill for them to swallow, as opposed to giving them the praise of like, oh, I really love how you handled that.
Yeah.
Or kind of like, oh, the way you really tried so hard was amazing. Like, and when you got a knockback, you tried again. So it's encouraging the more resilient-led traits. Just subtle change in the language, but it makes a huge play.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I was reading a bunch of research around this for International Women's Day, when I was doing a talk on overcoming fear. And it was exactly this, you know, as young women, particularly, you know, you're told, play it safe, don't do that, you'll get hurt. Like, it's always like, avoid the risks, avoid the fear of failure. And actually, if we sort of flip that on the head and like, taught our children, take the risk, there's no such thing as failure. Like, okay, no, you don't want your children jumping out of trees or whatever. And say, again, within reason. But, you know, if you teach them, you know, you can't fail. This is just a lesson learned. And actually try and move away from that black and white thinking and get them to operate in the grey from a young age and really lean into things that scare them, again, within reason. Actually, then as adults, we would have such a different approach to these things. And I think, you know, it would make life very different.
I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the things that really bugs me that you kind of touched on here is that there is this belief, and I would love to see the data and this and that and the other on it, but there's this belief that women are inherently more risk adverse than men. Like, men are more risk taking. And when you were talking then, it made me think, actually, is that just programming.
Yeah.
Is that just the lies or the narrative that we tell each other,
yeah,
or we tell our young girls as they grow up, and that just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Yeah, exactly.
If you tell someone to be risk-averse, or that they will be,
yeah,
well, are you surprised when they don't take risks?
No, exactly. And, you know, I think whenever... I always say these things with a pinch of salt, and these are just general research findings, you know, and obviously there's people in each camp, which there will always be differences, and it's not everyone, it's not every female does this, every male does that. But yeah, I definitely think there's a huge reason why women, females are more risk averse, is because we are taught from such a young age, we're primed constantly, don't take that risk. Yeah, and I think also we don't learn to deal with rejection as well, because everything's just... don't do that, stay away from that. And so therefore...
avoid the discomfort.
Exactly. And I really found that when I was on that sales floor, and I think it was like 800 people, and I was the only female on my team. And it was a really intense sales environment. And so you could get them rejected, honestly, about 100 times a day. And the men, it was like water off a duck's back. It was literally like someone had just said they'd won the lottery. Like, they just could not give a toss. And they would just pick up the phone and go again, pick up the phone and go again. And I was just sat there like, oh my gosh, like, how are they not being impacted by this? Like, for me, every time someone told me to F off, I like wanted to cry. And I was like, what is
this? It's a mindset, though. It's a mindset shift in that you get told to fuck off.
Yeah.
Right? In your mind, that's like, oh my fucking God, that's like... oh, this is something terrible about me.
Yeah.
Well, in the mind of those other guys, yeah, it's like, well, that guy's just one step closer for me getting a yes.
No, yeah, but exactly. They were like, well, he's an ob next. And this is it. And it wasn't until I have to apply the mindset they're applying, otherwise I'm never going to be able to do well in this job. And it wasn't until I started like being like, oh, well, on them next, like almost celebrating the fuck-offs, that
yeah,
you learn to do well. And so like learn in that way and approach it that way. And it's really interesting. I think it comes so much down to your environment and, you know, who's around you and how are they, what are they applying to things and actually how that rubs off on you.
Yeah, I mean, sales room floors are, I guess, they're one of those most intense boiler room situations that you can possibly be in. And it is, you know, in many regards, a true meritocracy where, you know, your numbers don't lie.
Yeah.
And it's about the number of calls you're making. It's about the number of sales that you're doing. And when you get onto that leaderboard, it's like, yeah, smashed it. And that... it's kind of like a great leveler for people. But as you say, it's that resilience, just keep going, realize that your mindset shift is more of, well, every rejection just gets me closer to the yes.
Yeah.
So essentially I'm just closer to winning.
Yeah.
And, but that's a very difficult shift to,
for sure,
to make. If you've never been taught that,
for sure,
you got that kind of baptism of fire, I suppose,
with
that experience.
And luckily I got it then when I was selling something I did not care about at all. Because now it makes it a lot easier.
You mean you don't care about stocks and bonds?
I know, right? So now when I've got something I actually really care about and really believe in, it's like, okay, well, if I get rejected, it's fine because I'm getting closer to where I need to be.
Yeah. Speaking of like something that you believe in, what are some of the things that you're like the most excited and pumped about and most hopeful for with all of the stuff that you've got going on and that you're seeing with, I'm hoping, the positive impacts that you're having and seeing in the greater?
I think we're in a really exciting time at the moment in general in terms of health tech. And I think there's so many amazing sort of companies around and doing some really, really cool things. And I'm really excited that we're sort of at the start of this journey and sort of at the right time to really be able to use all these cool things that are coming through in terms of like AI and, you know, what we now have access to really implement into our services to have this really futuristic sort of take on health and employee well-being, business performance. So that really excites me. And I think, you know, it's going to be a really interesting couple of years of where technology goes. I was reading recently something like we're now experiencing 40 years of technological change within 12 months.
Wow.
Which
it doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Mental.
I mean, because you've got Moore's Law, right? The computing power doubling every 12 to 18 months or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we are so far beyond. I don't think that is a metric by which we can judge where we are right now.
Yeah.
As you say, I completely buy that. 12 months, you know, 40 years.
Yeah. It's something like 100 years ago, they invented lights on the airport runways instead of bonfires. And that was like the big invention of the
year.
Wow.
Okay.
cool. know, like, wow, that's crazy. If that's just 100 years ago.
I mean, if I was involved, they'd probably still have bonfires. not a smart cookie on that, I'm afraid.
but yeah, so that excites me, being able to use the technology and really implement it to really help. I think with health especially, it's so overcomplicated and it's so overwhelming. And individuals get almost stressed by trying to take control of their stress. And so to have tools and to have coaching and services that can work with the individual and break down their own individual health for them and find and help them find the right solution for them and just cut out all the noise and all the rubbish that we see everywhere. Because that's all health is. Yeah, yes, okay, you know, there's guidelines, but realistically it's about finding what works for you. And that's the most important part. And once you do that, then you sort of are able to optimize every area of your life. And so that excites me that we have that sort of coaching and the tools available to really help the individual find what works for them.
Yeah, love that. I think one of the things that you touched on there, which is so crucial, is the amount of noise that exists in the fitness and wellness community and spaces where there is just kind of a lack of, well, it's almost like analysis paralysis that's going on with people.
It's crazy.
They don't know what to do
because
they don't know who to believe. And actually, we were having a conversation just a little while ago about, you know, there's so much information that also sounds believable that is just hokum and complete nonsense.
Gosh.
And it's never been more difficult.
ChatGPT's making it even worse.
Well, this
worse.
Is what I was going to say. It's never been so... misinformation has never been so believable.
I know.
So the fact that you're able to do something to simplify that for people that makes it, you know, that much more easy to action and that much more easy to do something with is a really important and really valuable mission, because I think, as you say, it really shouldn't be that complicated.
No.
But yet, when there's an industry that's out to make money from X fad diet or X fad fitness regime or whatever, it's difficult to cut
through.
Oh,
it's so infuriating. And it's so annoying that, you know, that I would go as far to say the majority of people given this information are fundamentally unhappy.
Yeah.
Most are unhealthy. And it's so infuriating when you've seen, like, behind the scenes to, like, the fitness industry, the wellness industry, how unfit and unwell it is, and these are the people given the advice to innocent brains.
Honestly, one of the things that really blows my mind, right? So I actually like the guy, and I think he's amazing in terms of, like, the whole consistency and work ethic. But Sebum, right? Incredible role model, incredible athlete. However, when he gets on stage at the Olympia, he is technically in his lowest form of health.
Yeah.
Ever, and that he will ever be. He is depleted of water. He is so low on body fat percentage that he has nothing around his internal organs to protect him from any sort of injury. And yet, we hold on a pedestal, literally hold on a pedestal, this ideal of a male physique or of someone. And you just think, right, we've gotten away from, and we are now even rewarding unhealthy obsessiveness around these things, where we need to get back to more of a calibration on what actually is healthy.
And it's crazy, exactly. And what is healthy? And every time there's a new trend or a new fad and a new hashtag, it just blurs that and muddies that more for people, that, you know, they no longer know where to look, where to turn, what health is.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing we're trying to overcome. I personally believe that everyone deserves a coach. It shouldn't just be something that the ultra wealthy should have access to, especially, like, if you're in a modern society and you're working hard. Like, everyone deserves to have that personal cheerleader and someone who they can work with to help them on that path. And it's more needed than ever, because there is just so much garbage out there. I was actually talking to a friend about it the other day, because I was saying how I don't even want to post on social media anymore. I was like, I just don't even want to be part of it. Like, it just infuriates me. I'm just, you know, I spend time and energy trying to add value, and I'm going up against everyone else in ChatGPT, and it's just boring me. And you can almost predict, like, what's going to be, like, the trend of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the, you know, so pandemic, stress. So when suddenly everyone is talk about stress management. And everyone's a stress management coach, you know? And now, at the moment, I've seen this whole, like, balance thing. So now everyone's talking about balance and how they're switching their phones off and how they're really resting hard and recovering even harder. And it's so much bollocks. It's that you're all lying. You're jumping on another trend and just mis-sharing misinformation that you're probably not actually doing. And now you're making people feel worse again.
Well, that's the thing that it seems like is the recursive loop for me, where it doesn't seem to make people feel better.
It does not make people feel better.
If anything, it's like, oh, Christ, I'm not resting hard enough.
Yeah.
I'm seeing like ex-fitness influencer or whatever. I'm not doing enough. And then you start stressing about the fact, you're stressed about being stressed.
Yeah.
Like, that was literally, I think, one of the things that you said earlier. It's like, you're stressed about your stress management.
Yeah.
Like, there's a bloody irony in that, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, I think we need to get away from that, and there needs to be a simpler approach. And that's why I really love what you're doing, what you're shooting for, because I think that it's one of the biggest problems in encouraging people to think more in terms of the broader societal impact with their health. And I'll get a little bit, this goes off a little bit tangential, but I think that we all do have a social contract with, particularly in the UK, within our kind of like healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be taking care of ourselves.
Yeah.
We should be looking after our mental well-being. We should be looking after our physical health and nutrition, so that we put less of a burden on that system as it goes on later on in life.
Yeah.
And then we would protect that thing that is a beacon, or what should be a beacon of healthcare, but instead we're so kind of like off in various different directions about what we should be doing, we just don't.
Yeah.
And that whole noise loop is just feeding into that, and it's not helping people.
No.
And at the point that it doesn't become helpful, I feel the same as you. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I just see, and I'm
so bored.
Yeah, and I find it just completely baffling. Yeah,
I know.
And the worst part of it is like, as someone that knows a little bit about stuff, you find yourself thinking, but this is common sense, right?
Yeah.
It should be common sense to know that this person's talking absolute waffle.
Yeah. But the truth is, health in general, taking control of your health, is really boring.
And it's just consistent.
It's just consistent, exactly. And so that doesn't get as many likes, that doesn't, you know, sell as many books or whatever. But what people have to understand is 80% of the time you have to be making a choice that your future self is going to thank you for. Yes, granted, there's no point living to 120 if it's 120 miserable years.
Great.
But, you know, if we're looking at not just lifespan, but health span, very different things. You know, if we're looking at a long health span, then yes, 80% of the time, we have to make a choice that our future self thanks us for. And that fundamentally comes down to, are you getting enough sleep? Are you eating enough fruit and veg? Are you drinking enough water? Are your connections and the people around you making you feel safe and loved? Are you personally growing? Are you professionally growing? Are you financially safe? Are you environmentally safe? It's all these facets that there's nothing fancy about them, but all of these eight areas, all these components of health have our attention and our energy to be the building blocks to a happy and healthy life. And that's what it is. And it's that every single day, 80% of the time. And that's boring and it's repetitive, but
yeah,
it's important.
It is, and it's funny because it's boring in the moment, but
yeah,
actually, if you think about it as like a view on the kind of like, if you took a back step on that, that's a life well lived.
Yeah.
It's like a life where you get to spend time with your family, your friends, your loved ones, a life where you are, you know, getting up in the morning or maybe doing some exercise, doing something that you love, that you really enjoy. I think, and most people would struggle to say that that's a life poorly lived. Actually, that's a life really well lived.
100%. And I think connections is one of the most important, relevant ones at the moment, because I think this is the one that's being overlooked a lot. Loneliness is on the rise. Now, despite being more connected than ever, why is loneliness the levels it is, you know? And we know there's all those crazy facts how loneliness kills more people than smoking cigarettes. You know, it's a real physical... Again, it's something that really physically impacts us. And I think in today's world, we're so busy. And I use that term because being busy is not a good thing.
No.
You know, we're so busy. We've got these targets, these deadlines, we've got all these arrangements, you know, we're constantly being distracted by our phones, emails, notifications, WhatsApp, social media, you know. There's so much going on that we're trying to manage, and it's coming at the cost of our actual relationships. And, you know, when we're sitting down for dinner, does that person have our full attention? When we're with our kids, do they have our full attention? You know, when someone's, oh, this is my absolute pet hate. If anyone does this to me, I could quite easily never speak to them again. If I'm talking about something that's really important to me, I'm going to be very Italian here.
I literally saw the hand gestures come out.
You can tell she's passionate.
I love it.
If I'm talking about something that really has bothered me or upset me, and this has happened so many times, and that person gets their phone out and is like, mm-hmm. I could honestly, I mean, that's our friendship over then. And yep, you fair. Have just ruined our friendship forever. Because I'm telling you something that's made me feel vulnerable or hurt me, and you've got your phone out, and that's more important than me right now, and I'm supposed to be someone you love. And how often do we do this, you know? And I'm not saying I'm perfect. We'll all be distracted by our phones at some points, of course. But we have to be invested in our real connections. We have to be physically there with these people. You know, we have entire neuroendocrine systems that respond to physical touch. We have to be finding time and being present with those we love, because it's probably the most important thing for our health.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that's just getting compromised again and again and again. And I think that's having a huge impact on our lives at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's one of the things that I watched the Netflix Blue Zones series. And that was one of the most consistent things running through all of them. The sense of community that they have, the connections that they have with their family, their friends, very often living next door or just down the road from each other, and having kind of like their glass of wine in the afternoon as they play backgammon.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
But you think about it, and it actually has so many other downstream consequences or levers that are involved that you don't even think about, where it's kind of like, well, you know, I'll walk down the street, but I'm still getting some steps in. So I'm exercising, I'm walking up there.
Yeah.
I'm playing a game, like something like backgammon, chess or whatever. So I'm using my brain. I'm training my brain to solve problems in real time. I'm communicating with someone. I'm having a laugh. I'm using all of these skills and all of these things. And you just see, actually, connecting with someone has so many more benefits that you don't even think, and you just take for granted. And that's something that I think you're completely right when you say we're more connected than ever, but never so disconnected.
Yeah.
And I am one person that genuinely does worry about that a lot.
Yeah.
Because I particularly worry about our younger generation.
Mm.
You know, we talk about how... I'm speaking for myself here, old enough to remember when phones were not a thing. I remember when there was this thing called a landline and you had to remember people's numbers. And so I've got to see this transition after, you know, mobile phones went from your brick of a Nokia through to your iPhone, and now this mythical device that no one can seem to keep their eyes off. And I worry about kids who are growing up now with that being their first interaction or port of call for the entire world that they are involved in. And then you add on top of that the comparison culture that we have with social media, and I just wonder, do we need a little bit of a step change? Do we need a lot of a step change, where actually we're in, how do we encourage more real world connections, and how do we get away from these devices is a real question that I think we all need to be thinking about.
Definitely. And how to we remain the masters of the devices, and the devices don't become our masters. Because I think a lot of the time, the devices now become the master.
Oh, 100%. How many times have you been to dinner and someone put their phone on the table?
Like,
I'm not being funny. It's my biggest pet peeve.
Yeah, me too. I really can't.
And don't get me wrong, I love my friends. But every time they sit at a dinner table and they put their phone on, so I'm like, dude.
I know. No,
seriously?
Or
they try and make it better, and they turn it upside down. And they're like, that doesn't make it better. If anything, it makes it worse.
It's annoying me even more.
Yeah, it really is. It's just like, if it's on the table and if it's upside down, then it doesn't need to be there anyway,
no,
does
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Because it's upside down, you won't see it.
Yeah, no, totally. And yeah, I think it's just, it's crazy. And that really, really winds me up. I obviously give so many talks on like stress management, and I've worked... worked with hundreds and hundreds of individuals at this point. And I think it's terrifying how whenever someone wakes up, what's the first thing you do?
Check your phone.
They check your phone. And I'm like, if the first thing you have done before you've even got out of bed, before you've even taken a few deep breaths, before you've even like had a moment to like check in with yourself, is get your device out, blue light, emails, WhatsApp, social media, news, fill your brain, flood your brain with all this information, usually a lot of it negative. You've already put yourself in a fight or flight response and you haven't even got out of bed.
Yeah.
And then you question why your stress levels are so high throughout the day and you haven't even got out of bed before you've put yourself in a fight or flight response.
Yeah.
And it's little things like this that make such a big difference.
It's one thing, and it sounds so random, please forgive me for it, but it's one of the things I can relate to with thinking that we should all be a little bit more cat-like.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this because if you ever watch... But no. But if you ever watch a cat get up from a nap, yeah, right, what's the first thing it does? It has a big old yawn and a good stretch.
Yeah.
And it sort of ambles about a little bit slowly and orientates itself to the world that it now finds itself in, master of all it surveys.
Yeah.
Well, we could learn a lot from that.
I'm going to steal this one.
Because we could.
Yeah, it's
like, you literally, true. What's the first thing that you should do when you wake up? Okay, set the phone aside. Just have a stretch.
Yeah.
Like, get the kinks out of the body first and foremost. Just orientate yourself to the world that you're now occupying.
Yeah.
And, you know, give yourself a few minutes.
No, totally.
Just give yourself a couple of minutes. It doesn't have to be the whole morning. It doesn't have to be a great big long morning routine.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
It could just be a couple of moments.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I couldn't agree more. It's a complete non-negotiable for me. And I think it would make such a big difference to everyone.
Yeah.
If you can just have that self-discipline. And, you know, what if something's happened, someone would have called you by now. There's nothing that you have missed overnight that can't wait an extra five minutes.
I have this book. I was going to show my reading list. The Daily Stoic.
That's my favourite book. Love it. I'm reading it for the fourth time this
year. Yeah. So basically, obviously, one of the recent ones was, you know, the control, what you can control.
Yeah.
Just accept that you can't control everything and that you just need to do the things that you can on the ones that you can.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's exactly that. If someone was trying to get hold of you, you know, that's out of your control. If something's happened, it's happened.
Yeah.
You don't have a time machine. You can't change it.
Totally.
So just orientate yourself to the day and to the moment. And then act accordingly.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the game of control is so fundamental to life and taking control of the controllables. And, you know, you can apply that to every single area, whether it's just walking another 1,000 steps a day, eating one more nutritious meal a day, checking in with one more person you love. When we feel out of control, we feel powerless. When we feel powerless, we feel anxious, we feel depressed. You know, these whole host of domino effects and negative consequences of feeling like we don't have control over everything. And as humans, one of the biggest misbeliefs we have is that we do have control over everything, because we never do. We might falsely believe we do, but we never do, truly. What do we have control over? Our thoughts, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Our actions. And how we respond to things, you know? And there's a huge difference between a reaction and a response. Reaction is something we are not controlling. It's that initial reflex. And it's that...
It's sending the angry email when someone said something that's annoyed
exactly.
you. Rather than taking
back.
A deep breath.
Exactly. And then responding. Thinking about the outcome you want and how you're going to get there. And I think in life we want to be controlling the controllables, thinking about our responses. We may not be able to change that really challenging situation, but we can take a step back and say, okay, how do I want to respond to this? We're not always going to get it perfect. It's not always going to be easy. But actually, we keep trying to do that, and eventually we learn how to respond really strategically.
Yeah.
Bringing those components we can control back within our control. And that's when we find our power.
Yeah, well, to me, what you've just described is your ability to perform at your very peak.
Yeah.
Because if you are able to take on board the inputs from the world, all of the good, the bad, the indifferent, and then respond in the way in which you want to and that is going to best serve you, that is peak performance. Because as you say, there's never a situation in which all the inputs are going to be completely ideal and that they're all going to be perfect and that they're all going to be things that you can control.
Yeah.
So the only thing that you have control over is how you have the discipline, I suppose, for want of a better term, to respond in the way that you would like to.
Exactly. And so, discipline's huge.
Yeah, it's the Jocko Willink, right?
Yeah.
Discipline brings freedom.
Exactly.
Which I absolutely, again, love. One of the things I was going to ask you is, what are some of the biggest movers or levers in your own life that have made the biggest difference for you in terms of, like, we're talking about, you know, discipline and stuff like that. What are some of the biggest things that you've found that have made the most profound impact with yourself as regards to your journey through all of this?
I think, and I've never really had a big victim mentality, but I think I've had times where, obviously, being in my early 20s, losing my father to a terminal illness, going through all that pain, you can at times feel like, why me? Why is this happening? And I think one of the biggest things I learned to do is flip that on its head and really find the challenges that have happened to me and the pain that's happened to me and be able to use that pain to my advantage, I think was huge. Because when you can start using your pain to your advantage, things become a lot less painful.
How did you do that? How did you find the way through to do that?
I think for me, it was what we just touched on, how, well, I could not control that situation. So the only thing I can control is how I respond to that situation. And thinking about, well, where do I want to be? What do I want to do? What do I want to achieve? What do I want to feel? And so actually, how am I going to get there? And so having a really good idea of actually, like, even sometimes not knowing exactly where I want to be, but knowing where I don't want to be, and making sure I'm always doing this all I can to be where I don't want to be.
Yep.
I think people put a lot of pressure on having these big fancy goals. And like,
do you know what? You've actually used a really beautiful frame there, because actually there is a very easy way to do the things that are going to take you away from, or that will get you to where you eventually want to be. Just do the things that are where you don't want to be.
Exactly.
And you will take the steps away from that situation.
Exactly. And so I've never had this clear vision of, like, this is my 5-year plan and this is what, you know, this is what I think success will be, like, da da da. But I've known where I don't want to be again. And so I do everything against that. And people say to me all the time, how do you get up at 5 a.m. every day? How do you work so hard? Like, how do you do this? How do you do that? How do you have all this motivation? And I'm like, I don't really think I have a lot of motivation at all. I think I have an abundance of self-discipline.
Mm.
And they're very, very different. And I think, you know, people wait for motivation. They wait for the right time. And they don't realize, actually, you have to action. You have to do. And then the motivation follows. And whenever I talk about this, people are like, what? I always use Newton's first law. Like, an object in motion stays in motion. You get the most resistance at the start when you're first trying to move that object. And it's exactly the same with motivation. So you are going to get the most resistance at the beginning. But actually, when you get moving, you rely on that self-discipline, you get moving, the motivation follows. And so how do you become self-disciplined? Habit. And being able to nail just turning up. Just turn up, turn up, turn up. Don't think about how much you want to achieve. Don't think about all the bells and whistles. Just nail the basics. Nail the art of turning up every day and building those habits. And then once you've built the habits, you can make them fancy. You can add to them.
Yeah.
But first off, just nail showing up.
I fucking love what you just... I mean, that there's so much to unpack under that. But I think one of the biggest things that you've hit on as well is that the more of those things that you do, the more of that evidence that you create for yourself. So when you do have those days where you don't feel that motivated, well, actually, you've got this fucking pile of days that you have. And it's like, I'm not breaking that streak.
Yeah.
Like, that's not who I am. Like, this is, I've built this, you know, I've built this kingdom. I'm not going to let this, you know, this cornerstone drop on it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason that I think it becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy, like compounding interest.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love that you say that you're not, you know, a particularly motivated person. It's just discipline.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much wisdom in that. I think it's so true. It's, you know, the ability to just prove to yourself before anyone else
Yeah.
that you are the kind of person that can do that, carries so much weight, and the conversations that we have with ourselves and internal dialogue that we have is a really, really powerful tool that I don't think people give enough credit. 100%. You know, the bargains that we make with ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to eat that cookie, or I'm going to go to the gym, or I'm going to go, you know, I'm even just going to go for a walk around the block. Yeah. And then you don't do it. That's damaging.
Yeah. 100%.
But if you do it, the yield that it gives you is so much greater than the
100%. And I really think it's like periodization. It's like April to September, most motivated person in the world. I'm Italian, it's sunny. Like, you know, it's when I get up, it's sunny. When I go to bed, it's sunny. I love it. The other 6 months here, I'm not motivated. And understanding that you can have those periods and you can still move forward and you can still push the needle. And actually, there's other ways to do it. And I think, you know, exactly what we said, that internal dialogue is so important. And I think a huge thing for me is the self-comparison piece.
Yeah.
And whenever you're outside your comfort zone, it's really easy to start comparing yourself and start doubting yourself. I've had it loads recently. I call her Bellatrix. It's my little annoying little voice when she tries to come and be a
okay.
bitch.
Is that a Harry Potter reference?
Maybe, because she's just a bitch.
Yeah, Bellatrix the Strange.
Yeah, and she just tries to ruin, she comes in and tries to ruin my life, and I'm like, not today, okay? Not today. She used to come out when I was really drunk, but I don't drink anymore, so now it's just... And I have to remember, it's like, so she'll come about, and, you know, it's that whole... Well, okay, for example, I've been asked to go on quite a lot of podcasts recently, and I'm like, why would you go on these podcasts? Who are you to talk about anything? Like, you haven't even achieved anything. Like, okay, you've raised your pre-seed investment. Okay, you've launched a little company. Like, you know, and it goes in. And then you suddenly start looking and like, suddenly I think I should be like Jeff Bezos or something if I want to go and talk about anything. Do you know what I mean? And it's just, maybe that's not the best example, but, you know. And so it's about, well, actually... being aware of when that dialogue's coming in and being aware of how harmful it can be, and actually not trying to argue with it. Because when we try to argue, it's like trying to argue with a best friend. If that voice is shouting at you, you start shouting back. All we create is tension. In psychology, we call it cognitive dissonance. But we create that tension, nothing gets resolved. So it's not even, okay, I'm going to argue with this. It's going to just be, okay, today I'm not going to do this. Actually, today I'm going to do this anyway, because why not? And if I still feel like that tomorrow, maybe I get some attention to it. And just every day putting that full stop on it and not engaging in that harmful conversation, not engaging with that self-comparison. A big thing for me is always I remind myself, are you enjoying it? And if the answer is yes, then I'm like, then screw what everyone else is doing. Screw if you think they're doing better, if they've got more customers, you know, if they've got on bigger, like, I don't know, PR presses, whatever it might be, you know. It's like, well, are you enjoying how you're spending your days? Are you enjoying what you're working on? Are you enjoying who you're working with? Are you enjoying who you're hanging out with? And if the answer is yes, then you suddenly like, why am I comparing myself? Because I'm enjoying this.
100%.
And I think that's, there's a lot of power in that. We get so lost in the comparison, we forget to ask ourselves, well, are you enjoying yours?
Yeah, and I think that there's a mindset of just being present to feel that enjoyment, to really own that space, because we, for the majority of us, we seem to live our lives either in the future or in the past.
Yeah.
There's a comparison with, you know, who we were or whatever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can use that to your advantage to be like, yeah, cool, I don't want to go back to that place, and I use it as a momentum to go forward. There's the future state comparison. It's like, but why are you measuring against something else that may or may not happen, because the future is as yet unwritten, but it's your present that writes it, and your ability to enjoy it and take the positive step forward with that enjoyment and really become that is where find your joy.
So I
completely resonates with me, and I absolutely love that way of looking at things, because it means, I mean, I feel exactly the same way. I'm very lucky to say this, that I get to have outstanding conversations with incredible people doing sensational work. That is the most wonderful thing and wonderful privilege that I could ever have in my life.
Yeah.
And I have no idea, like you, where this road takes me in the future. I don't have a plan.
Yeah.
Many people would think I have a plan. I don't have a plan. Yeah. I'm just enjoying the ride at the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm very much thankful to the people.
And you know where you don't want to be.
Exactly. Exactly. See, I know where I don't want to be. I don't quite know where I want to be. Yeah. I just know that it probably, and this is my own issue, whatever. I just know that it probably will never be enough.
Yeah.
It's that, because I'm enjoying it so much, I don't want it to stop.
Yeah.
I just want to keep going and going and going.
And that's what you have to be careful of, isn't it? Is that moving of the goalpost before you've scored the goal.
Yes.
Which is really difficult, especially, again, type A personalities and being ambitious. We're so guilty of, well, yeah, I've got there. Of course I'd get there. There wasn't any other option. So we hit the goal and then we move it. And actually, it's that constant chase and making sure to take a step back, go, actually,
celebrate the win.
This is enough.
Yeah. That's something that I'm, again, any tips on that you have, please let me know. Answers on a postcard.
It's really hard. It is really hard. But I think it's important, because it also then, come back to that internal dialogue piece, it's given ourselves the correct message that we've worked hard, we've done enough, you're enough as you are. Yes, you can want more, and yes, you can work towards more, but that doesn't mean you're any less right now.
Yeah.
And actually taking a step back to have that conversation with ourselves before we then go on to the next thing. I'm going to check in on you on that one.
Fair. Speaking of next things, what's next for you?
Sleep. Yeah, I think, you know, it's just going to be,
especially with those 5 a.m. starts. Yeah, you're going to need your sleep.
Yeah, I am a morning person, and I guess I'm lucky for that. Although, like, if you try and get me to do anything that involves my brain past 7 p.m., really, I struggle. 7 to 8 p.m., I can.
So no podcasts in the States then, or on stateside time?
No, well, because I do a lot with Australia, and so I'll always pick 6 a.m. our time. And they're like, what? And I'm like, trust me, this is way better for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think, you know, it's just, it's going to be a really interesting year. We hard launched in August last year. And so this year is going to be the first full year as Human OS. And that's going to require a lot of work and a lot of energy. So it's just about putting all the steps in place to really, you know, do as well as we can this year and do everything we want to do. And that's pretty much where all my energy is going at the moment. And I'm happy with that. I enjoy that.
Yeah.
You know, I think life happens in periodizations, and we can be very hard on ourselves and think we have to do everything really well all of the time. And actually, it's not about that. It's about periods of really applying energy to some parts and other parts just doing the minimum you need to do to keep them going. And so, you know, I've learned to be really gentle with myself in that process. And right now it's go time, it's business time. That's where the energy is. That's what we're going to do. There's goals that have been set and things I want to get done.
Yeah.
And I won't stop till they are.
Love that. You reminded me of something that Karen, our accounts director, says: where focus goes, energy flows.
Exactly.
And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that.
What's next for you?
Wow, that's a... Well, there you go. That's a big question. So I think this year, really for us, it's diversification and trying to really expand on the offering that we have. I think we've niched down into healthcare properly last year and wanting to bring more of that design thinking to companies. I think there's a lacking systems thought process within a lot of these organizations and a focus on quite myopic problems where actually if we tackled the bigger landscape, we'd actually create more meaningful change in those systems that would ultimately benefit more people because the people internally with those companies would see more of the value that they bring. That value distance between them and the customer would be shorter and then they'd be able to do more amazing and meaningful stuff together. That's one of the things, continuing with the podcast, obviously, and doing this stuff.
Great podcast.
Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Shameless plug. You heard it here first. And then I think there's other markets that we're looking at as well.
Nice.
Expansions overseas and stuff like that. So it will be a big year. It will be an interesting year, I think.
I mean, the wellness healthcare space in other markets at the moment is just gigantic.
It's huge. Yeah. And you touched on this before as well, you know, with machine learning, artificial intelligence, and the ability to centralize or capture data that can be understood and then pushed out in an intelligent but simple enough way to understand to do something with. I mean, there's so much that I've learned over the last little while in terms of, you know, health markers that can be identified from wearable data that would tell you whether or not someone's, you know, going to get Parkinson's or have Parkinson's 7 years ahead of when they would usually get a diagnosis by a clinician. AI being used in scans for, you know, neurodegenerative conditions. So brain scans being looked at by some amazing companies. And there's so much downstream.
It's so cool.
Yeah, it's just it's such an exciting space to be able to operate in, to be involved in, to have conversations with people like yourself doing insane work that's ultimately going to bridge the gap between, you know, our current state, our current operating system, which is less than ideal, to hopefully a better one, and making a bigger impact. Because I think, ultimately that's what I think we all seek. We all seek to you know, one of the probably the more ethereal parts of that, you know, that, what's it called, that Blue Zone show that I thought about was, there's a meaning, the ikigai, right? The Japan one really resonated with me, and that there needs to be that meaning in what you're doing, and the felt sense that what you're doing is contributing to something greater than yourself.
Have you read Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl?
I haven't. It's on the list. It's on the list.
My favourite book of all time.
Okay. I definitely need to look that one.
Exactly to what you're talking about now, though, so...
Okay.
Bring that up.
So maybe I'm on the path. I'm on the path.
Exactly. But no, it's so true.
Yeah, it really... It's something that, on my own personal journey, that's been something that I've been very, very... mindful of. I've wanted to do something that hopefully brings value to people, that would be something that, touch wood, and maybe if at some point I do have kids, they'd be able to look back at their old man and say, yeah, we were quite proud of what he did, and he did something that was halfway decent with his life. So
well, it sort of ties into like two of the key pillars of health as well, with being that like, your spiritual health and your occupational health, right? And so going back to covering all your bases, if they're not being looked at, and if you don't give them attention, then we won't live a happy, healthy, fulfilled life.
Yeah. I've thought about the, not to go too down the rabbit hole on this, I have thought about the spiritual health a lot more recently. Yeah. It's not been something that I've particularly looked at in the past or or given any great degree of, of thought to, being much more in the here and the now type person. But it is something that I do think actually... I am looking at in
and,
more.
And again, this is something I think, you know, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be this big overwhelming, overarching sort of question where you're suddenly like, what do I believe? And, you know, what is behind all of this? Which you can do, absolutely. You know, and if you want to go down that rabbit hole, do. I frequently go down it. You know, I love that sort of stuff.
Theology and...
Yeah, you know, I really, yeah, it just, my brain just adores it. But it can be as simple to begin with as, you know, in your day, are you taking time to slow down? Are you taking time to check in with yourself? Are you taking time to see what's around you, feel what's around you? You know, ask yourself if you're okay. Are you just slowing down? And are you implementing this into your day so that your spiritual health actually has a chance? You know, you're not just constantly in this fight versus flight, this sympathetic nervous system. We're also spending time in the parasympathetic, the rest and digest. You know, we didn't evolve to always be in fight or flight.
Yeah.
And modern society constantly pushes us into that state. And I think a lot of our spiritual health, yes, can go on to asking the bigger questions, but at a very basic level is, are you giving your mind, your body time to rest? So it can even start to comprehend the questions. Like, are you just giving it a moment of being quiet with itself? And breathing, you know, something as simple as like just two. I read something the other day, down the rabbit hole we go, that it was like 5 minutes of breath work in the morning is enough to reduce stress, anxiety, and depression for 2 days.
Wow.
You know, and so something like that and the impact that's going to have on our spiritual health is huge. And again, so it's taking this big overarching, what can be really overwhelming facet of health, and making it really simple and implementing that in the most simple way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to work out the fractional in my head as to kind of 24 hours a day, 5 minutes.
And you can go even further. It doesn't even have to be at one go either. So then they found out that the positive impacts of breath work throughout the day, the cumulative effect still has.
So just take a minute.
Yeah, or every time you boil the kettle, make your exhale longer than your inhale. And do that every time you boil the kettle. For me, I'd be great because I love tea. So I'd be like the most zen person in the world. I don't know what the average kettle boiling time here is in this study. I'll need to find out.
I love that. For all of those that like tea out there,
that's
your top tip.
Exactly.
Your top tip, on top of your PG tips,
is to
take your minute to breathe.
PG's top tips. We should sell this to them.
There's their marketing strategy.
There's something in here.
Oh my God. No, cut.
We've gone from spiritual health back to sales. This is classic sales
book here. Awful.
Within 30 seconds, we've gone from like, this is the meaning of life to this is how we make money.
This is how we make money,
obviously. This is our personalities to a T.
I know. God.
So funny. It's so good.
Bianca, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so, so much for your time.
I think
I can think of no better way to end on such a lovely, simple tip that people can use to create a positive PG tip to leave with a positive impact. If people want to find you, where can they go? How can they get involved in Human OS?
Yep. So LinkedIn, Bianca Arrigo, E-R-R-I-G-O. Confuses people. And we're humanos.co.uk is our website. Bianca@humanos.co.uk. You can email me, ask me any questions, follow up with me. I would love to hear from everyone.
Incredible. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I have. It's been absolutely wonderful having Bianca here. Please like and subscribe wherever you're watching or listening to this, and we'll catch you soon.